When you save on auto insurance for driving safe with USAA Safe Pilot, you'll feel like a big deal. Even in a traffic jam. Save up to 30% with USAA Safe Pilot. Restrictions apply.
This is ContactTalkRadio.com, consciousness in action, and you are taking action into your consciousness by tuning into Contact Talk Radio.
And on TuneIn.com, Ping.fm, and UpSnap Mobile.
Contact Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Dr. Madeira Show, where he will discuss testosterone optimization and full body health for the high-performance modern man. Now, here's your host, Dr. Madeira.
Howdy, everybody. It's Dr. Madeira here, back on my show. And today we have Dr. Paul Anderson. How's it going today, Dr. Paul Anderson?
Very good.
Awesome. And you're a repeat, basically, member of the show now. So this is awesome. Thanks for coming back. And you're also author of Out of the Box Cancer Therapies with Dr. Mark Stenger, and you've co-authored a book with Jack Canfield, Success Breakthroughs, and you're working on another book currently.
Yes. Yeah, it's a book. It's coming out. Well, it would have been coming out a little sooner, but all of the COVID excitement has slowed the final edits down a little bit. But it's called Cancer, Living Your Life While You Have It. And it's about how to deal with unpleasant diagnoses, and whether it's you or your loved one, just navigating sort of the internal journey of a diagnosis that nobody wants, but many people have to deal with. So we're shooting for a summer launch for the book.
Spectacular. I look forward to that. And I have your book on my shelf now, and I know a lot of other people have it on their shelf. So if people don't have the book on your shelf and someone in your family has been affected by cancer, or you have been diagnosed by cancer, please pick up Outside the Box Cancer Therapies. Today, we're going to talk about COVID-19 pandemic, novel coronavirus, and what can be done. So first of all, what does COVID-19 mean? What are we talking about? What kind of virus is this?
Yeah, it's this is not unusual. There's confusion that happens kind of, especially on the front end of something like this. You'll hear the so-called maybe family of a virus. So viruses aren't alive like bacteria. So with bacteria and other creatures, you have a genus and a species and all this taxonomy. Whereas with virus, you divide them up by them. They're mechanistic in the way they work, and they're like little tiny machines. And so they're divided by the mechanisms by which they do their dirty work. So people originally got really kind of like a lot of conspiracy theory things saying, oh, well, I got a 10-year-old can of Lysol and it says coronavirus on it, so it can't be a new virus. And so coronaviruses have been around for as long as viruses have been around. And it's a family. And they're named because once we could image them, say with electron microscopy, they look like a crown, sort of a round crown, actually. So corona basically means crown. So that's the family. The problem with viruses that happens is their life cycle is dependent on one of two things, and usually both. One is going from different species of the animal kingdom. So maybe it's a virus that really likes one kind of animal and never leaves there, but periodically goes to another animal and mutates. The other side is what I just said, mutation. And so you can take something like a coronavirus that could cause, common cold symptoms or other symptoms and be fine because you've seen it before, et cetera. But what'll happen is, and it's very analogous, not same virus kingdom or family, but it's analogous to like the bad influenzas that have become epidemic or pandemic. So, for example, to use common names, like the swine flu or the bird flu, et cetera, those are ones that left the human population for sometimes quite a while. They go out to an animal population. So, you know, then pigs get blamed or birds get blamed or whatever, but they go to an animal population, usually multiple animal populations. They mutate to deal with the animal. The animals get used to them and either die or develop immunity. Then they leave the animal, they go back to people, and gee, we've never seen this before. And so our immune system just, you know, wigs it out. So whether it's something, you know, like SARS or swine flu or et cetera, that's the virus's job is to mutate, and they do it best when they leave the humans and come back. So coronavirus, the current coronavirus, known as COVID-19 is the kind of moniker for this kind of coronavirus infection in humans. So the disease state, and then the SARS-CoV-2 is the infectious agent. So it's actually a mutated coronavirus. And the fact that it's pandemic, the fact that it's done its job to get in us, and there's different pathogenic kind of gambits it has to make us think we're healthy when we're not, so we spread it. It's perfect if you're a virus. Like, it's done everything right to be a virus. As far as humans go, it's done everything right to be a virus, and our bodies and our communities weren't ready for it. So that's why we're where we're at.
Okay. So we've had a family of coronaviruses since there's been viruses, essentially. And then this virus is the SARS-CoV-2, and then there was SARS-CoV-1, which was the SARS infection from the early 2000s, 2003-ish. Mm-hmm. With this version, I guess, update, if you will.
Yeah.
Yeah. The upgrade, which is more global than the initial mm-hmm. SARS, was more mm-hmm. Endemic to China from in Asia, mm-hmm. from what I remember.
In Toronto,
yeah.
Yeah, they had a big, because of travel, and Toronto's a big hub. But it's actually this is an aside, but hey, I'm a regular now. It's like I'm a guest, like a Johnny Carson regular. There's a hospital right next to a place that I used to teach a lot at up in Toronto. And it was the epicenter for SARS. And so they actually had a bronze statue to the people who literally just sort of lived in the hospital and took care of SARS patients. So it was a pretty big deal there. But it didn't become pandemic like this one. And a lot of that had to do with the fact that the best way, if I was a virus, what I would do is I would be asymptomatic in as many people as possible for as long as I could. That's what creates spread. If you're an infection that, like, you start to die quickly, or you did, like, the symptoms come on quickly, things shut down quickly, like, and you don't go anywhere. If you're a virus and you hang out in people a long time and they can travel around the world, that's pandemic fixins right there. Yeah.
Yeah. So our global economy, with people traveling around the world, and the first mm-hmm. US case being from a gentleman who went to China and came back to Snohomish mm-hmm. County from China in, I think it was January 20th, end of January, right?
Yeah.
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 And it's an RNA virus, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So RNA viruses, just so people know, so you mentioned SARS, there's most of the list of RNA viruses I'm going to tell you, you will have heard of, or maybe, and none of them are really great. So another famous one is Ebola. So we've heard of Ebola. You bleed out, you know, a lot of the horrible things there. SARS, rabies. The common cold actually is in this family too. We'll talk about why. So remember, the joke's always been, if you can find a cure for the common cold, you know, you win the Nobel Prize, and you never do. There's a reason for that. Influenza family, hepatitis C, hepatitis E, which is super deadly in certain instances, West Nile virus, polio, measles, and there's a few others. So there's nobody good on that list, right? These are RNA virus, and then RNA virus have a sort of an offshoot, and depending on who in virology you talk to, they're part or not part of the clan. And those are the retroviruses like HIV. So there's nobody good in the RNA community as far as viruses go, but they do their job for infecting people well. And if you look at that list, like Ebola and hepatitis E and C and West Nile and everything, some of them, you know, nobody would live long enough to develop immunity like Ebola or something like that. Some of them, like common cold, the common cold goes around as long as we've known about signs and symptoms. So people didn't know about viruses till fairly recently in human history, but we have reports of symptoms that probably were viruses. So long as we've been here, viruses probably have too. But the common cold, the reason you never can like make an immunization for it or cure it or whatever, or why would you get a cold this year and another one next year, is that family mutates so fast and it spreads through humanity so quick. The only reason we don't say there's a common cold pandemic is most people don't die from it, right? There's not a reason to like call out that the world is circulating the common cold, because it is and it has forever. But people aren't dying, so it doesn't reach that level of notoriety. Whereas stuff like West Nile, you know, people did die, and had, I don't know when you and I, if we were in Arizona at the same time, but I was there about 15 years ago, and I actually had patients with West Nile and some of the other related viruses when they first came to the U.S. Arizona for some reason was where we got some. Now, most of our patients, of course, didn't die, but they had really long, horrible, lingering symptoms, a lot of neurological symptoms and stuff. So the family of RNA viruses are, one of the things they do best is mutate, which I said is one of the best ways to have a good virus that gets around. You think about it, if you're the virus, you want to get as many organisms as you can so that you replicate and get to more organisms. So the ability to mutate makes you novel. So when they say a novel coronavirus, COVID-19, that means the old coronavirus gets a new, you know, a couple of new upgrades and goes right past your immune system. So you never know it's there. And that's really why it's so successful as a virus.
You know, when you talk about it, it does sound scary. For the listener, it does sound like, wow, okay, so this is a new virus, it's an RNA virus, it can mutate more. I've heard they've already confirmed that it has mutated several times already, this version, the COVID-19 novel coronavirus, is that correct?
Yeah, it's interesting. So literally a mile and a half or so, right behind where I'm sitting, is the hospital where the first patient we knew about in America was here in Snohomish County. And of interest to me, and it's just because I watch these sort of things happen, the CDC originally put out some of their genetic findings early on that they did, where they were mapping the genome of this patient and then a couple others that were in our area. And what they noticed was there were sub-mutations, and they said, well, it's possible, and this is like a month and a half ago before people were really talking a lot about this, they said, because there's even sub-mutations to COVID-19, there's two people in the same two-county area that had the same sub-mutation, meaning the other person who wasn't in the hospital may have been part of a cohort that existed prior to this guy that went to the hospital. So patient zero may not really be patient zero. Well, this got reported by some big news outlet, you know, some very, it is not like, you know, me just putting it on Facebook or something. This is like a real reporter. And it got around, and then the CDC started to not comment at all on any of the reporting that was in it because they realized what they were saying after they sort of told this. And that's been that. So in pandemic time, that's a long time ago, you know, 6 or 7 weeks. So it's very obvious, and the CDC doesn't deny that they said it. They just said no more after that. So they're not elaborating greatly anyway. The biggest thing about it is, which may or may not be a problem as far as developing immunity if you get it, is you and, you know, your neighbors could have the same disease from COVID-19, but two different mutation strains. Now, what it appears, and here's where you got to really be careful because we don't have enough data to say, oh, you know, 90% of people become immune or whatever. We don't know, you know, there's a lot, like we're not testing enough people to know, but minor submutations usually don't make the virus penetrate differently. So if you and your neighbors had two slightly different mutations, you probably are going to be, you know, immune to both, right? If it mutates again, like the common cold, it could come back again. Now, things that are this bad, kind of like the swine flu and stuff, that usually takes decades. They leave and go back. But yeah, it's highly, RNA viruses are random. They mutate way faster than other viruses. And they get in and they replicate based on their mutations, usually faster than other viruses do. Yeah. We need to get to the good news part of the story, though. So far, we're hitting the bad news part really, really well.
Yeah, bad news first. Well, hopefully we'll get there. Our plan is to get there, so stick with us.
Yeah.
It will get better. It will get worse first, kind of like naturopathic treatments.
Right. yeah.
So it is pretty challenging to treat this, like you're saying, because it is has the potential to mutate, and there are some mutations out there that, as you mentioned, have been around for 6-7 weeks or so in the U.S. And, you know, hopefully our listeners are wondering how to optimize their immune systems. I mean, obviously, as we discussed before we hit record, there's no research on really any treatment for COVID-19. And the hospital care is basically oxygen fluids and then if they need it, ventilator when they can't breathe for themselves anymore because of hypoxia. Is that part of the mechanism of the virus? Is it taking out the ability for oxygen to bind to the hemoglobin in the red blood cells, or is it mostly attacking the cells in the alveolar part of the lungs?
Yeah, I think what's emerging as far as papers and stuff, and you know, one I just saw last night, it was, so here in the Northwest, it's the trees are blooming, great allergy season. I woke up coughing, and of course your first thought is, oh, I must have coronavirus, but it was my allergies. So that, you know, that got me looking at the internet. I don't know why coughing made me look at the internet, but I'm reading these articles about hemoglobin, which takes my mind off my allergies. So by the way, I tested negative for COVID-19. So your listeners can know I'm clear, but, I did get tested. But it appears that there's three different ways in my mind, and then not ways, but like phases of insult to the body that this thing does. The two that you mentioned are the ones that get you in the hospital and maybe don't let you leave the hospital alive. Okay, so those are like the worst ones. The alveolar effect is huge, and that's better known. But then there's this oxygen hemoglobin metabolism deal that this RNA virus may have another avenue in to messing you up as a human. And the bottom line is, if you look at that, so almost everyone at this point has read or heard about something ominous called a cytokine storm that kills you. That's on the inside of the lungs at the level of the alveoli and the internal immune function there. And obviously, if the alveoli are supposed to help you perfuse your blood with oxygen and get rid of CO2, if we damage that, we're not going to live very long. So that's one way. But imagine if you had this really brilliant viral layout where you not only cause this inflammation inside the lungs, but on the blood side of the oxygen transfer, you screw up the ability of the protein that allows O2 and CO2 to go back and forth to do their job. Well, now you have someone who's compromised on the oxygen transfer end, and they're compromised at even getting the oxygen into your blood. So although that's emerging sort of data, it makes a lot of sense that a really, really well, you know, I'm going to say thought up, like somebody thought this up, but it, we'll just stick with that. A really well, you know, planned out machine that infects organisms like humans would go on both sides of the ledger. And that kind of, like, that makes it more pathogenic. It makes you die. It's sort of like Ebola makes you die faster, so it doesn't spread quite as fast. But like Ebola has multiple ways to mess up the same systems. If you don't breathe, you don't live. Everyone knows that. So that's a huge thing. But one of the things that I've been interviewed so much, it's like this is a recurring theme also. Long before you get to the lung problems or the hemoglobin problems, the other area that really every virus and cold and flu season and every other in modern life messes up is your first defense system in your immunity, where you're not so concerned who's coming in, you're just concerned about blocking as many people as you can coming in that are viruses and bacteria and whatever else going around. If we didn't have an immune system doing that, we'd be dead all the time. I mean, do we just die? The thing about that, though, is that primary kind of the first responder part of your immune system uses tons of nutrients inside your body to operate, which, I mean, that's the way we work, right? Our cells need nutrients to run, and that's why we eat food and drink water and all that stuff. Well, if it's cold and flu season especially, you're burning through the nutrients for your first responders. Those happen to be the same nutrients that are used in these other phases when we get into the lung. And so if I've spent 6 weeks or 8 weeks in cold and flu season fighting off everyone else's junk that they have, and I haven't repleted my nutrients well, and I'm not rested, and I'm not hydrated, and all those good things, then I get a novel virus getting into me because someone sneezed or I touched something or whatever. I now don't have the resources to fight this. And so then my immune system and my lungs doesn't respond appropriately. And probably my hemoglobin concentration is not correct because of there's not enough goodies there. And so the lack of nutrients that I gave away preventing all the other illnesses now is coming back to roost and haunting me. So I think that the silver lining there is, if you know that, most people forget that, like, we're fighting stuff off all the time. That's our body's job, but it's at a cost. And in cold and flu season, it's a pretty high cost of water-soluble nutrients. So that part we can do something about. You can't help getting the virus or not usually. I mean, you can isolate and all that stuff, but, like, what can you do? You can do stuff to support your first response and your second response systems. And that's, I think that's the silver lining, because we have control over that.
Excellent. So what are some nutrients? I mean, a lot of people have asked me, and I know you've been interviewed about this a lot. A lot of people think, you know, zinc for immune system, vitamin C. I just got an email from a patient that is taking liposomal vitamin C orally, vitamin D, vitamin A. And the other thing before you get into your answer is it's really hard to find any of this stuff right now, even if you're a practitioner. So If you're listening to this, don't try to stockpile for the next 12 years. Just Get what you need because, you know, a lot of people need it, and they needed it before COVID-19 and they really need it now. So,
Yeah,
too bad.
I I would echo that. Just even if you can find whatever it is you're looking for, don't buy all of it. You're not going to need all of it. Okay. And I mean, it's sad, but true. Like, and there was even some, just as our clinic kind of made up some things for our patients that were prepackaged and, you know, all the pills in a little pack. When we were designing that, some of the more, I'll call them the more famous herbal mixtures, they couldn't get, like, it was just, they were just gone, you know, and it was because it was like kind of viral focused or whatever. But really, if you looked at the broad, I said, well, let's look at all of the herbal mixtures. Well, there are many that are fine. And they're not famous for viruses or whatever. So we just did some substitutions. But it's like even at the manufacturing level, that became a problem, and it still is a problem. I've literally had people tell me, especially like friends in New York City, that, you know, like they have friends who are pregnant, exposed or whatever. And it's like vitamin C, we know is pretty safe, and other stuff. And they can't find it anywhere. Like it's that bad. So don't buy it all. And anything we say here, you know, obviously these are like, I can tell you what I do and what I give my family and stuff. But if you're going to go into heavy dosing of nutrients, please work with a naturopathic doctor or somebody who's trained to do that. But of all the things that you said, and I think we'll probably wind up talking about vitamin C a lot. So the other one that people are, and I hope this doesn't make this go off the shelves totally, but it's a natural agent that's based on an amino acid, cysteine. So it's N-acetylcysteine, which is a form of cysteine that absorbs well if you take it by mouth. It's actually also a drug used in hospitals to what? Clear ventilators that are plugged up with mucus. So N-acetylcysteine is cool in a couple of ways. One is it's not terribly expensive. I'm sure it's more now than it was 6 weeks ago, but it's not terribly expensive. It's water soluble. It supports this mucus. It's not like getting rid of mucus. It's just keeping it thin enough to do its job. Because mucus, we think of mucus as bad, but that's when we have too much. Mucus carries our immune proteins and other goodies that we need in our lungs and our respiratory system. So we don't want it to go away, but we want it to flow. In these things like, you know, COVID, it gets sticky because there's so much immune protein it can't move. So N-acetylcysteine is helpful there, but it's also helpful in supporting production that your body does of glutathione, which is helpful to vitamin C and other stuff. So I think N-acetylcysteine on top of the other, like zinc has become really popular. I don't watch a lot of news because it drives me crazy to hear people talking about all this. But I think even like there was a presidential briefing where they mentioned zinc, or it's like, oh, good. So, and zinc is a little complicated. We'll talk about, but zinc is very important. So if you think about like your first defenders, zinc, vitamin C, all the water soluble stuff, they burn them up when you're in cold and flu season. You get into the deeper parts like your lung, things like vitamin D and vitamin A, which are fat soluble and do build up. So you want to work with some of you taking a lot of that. But vitamin C and NAC, and then some of the other elements that, you know, should be coming in your diet, but usually aren't, super important to lung immunity.
Excellent. Yeah. And one thing that made me think a little bit more about zinc is I was watching this YouTube video, and this physician, or he may be a physician assistant. I'm pretty sure he's an MD, maybe an MD, PhD, actually. The MedCram YouTube
channel. Oh, yeah. That's great. Yeah.
Yeah.
I love those.
Yeah. It's great for the visual learners, which I definitely am. Yeah. And I think you are too, right? Because I remember your drawings from the lectures at Vassar University and the hamburger for the heme and for the fond memories of those. And
visual learners do well with me. Yeah. That's why I like that MedCram guy. Yeah.
Yeah. And he talks about zinc and then the zinc ionophores. And there's this research that came out of, I think it was Europe, maybe France. Correct me if I'm wrong, with the azithromycin and the was it the
hydroxychloroquine?
Yeah, chloroquine. So, and I believe you mentioned this in one of your webinars about that being a potential drug-drug interaction, especially for people who have pre-existing heart conditions with the prolongation of the arrhythmias and all that technical stuff. But a lot of people have been sharing on social media about the hydroxychloroquine, but his video really showed how that zinc with the hydroxychloroquine can really help it push it into the cell as it is a zinc ionophore. Are there other natural things, natural medications that can help zinc do that, that aren't going to cause somebody to go, you know, get this prescription, which is also used for people who have lupus? So they need this medication. So we can't just take all the medication and give it to everybody to have them take zinc. But are there other ways that people can do this safely?
Yeah, that's a really good point. So while zinc itself as a supplement is good to build your blood levels up and your storage levels up for your first responders who don't need this other process that the virus fighting needs, zinc is really important. And like I said, if you've been, you know, even you're one of those people, I never get colds and flu, it's because you have a good immune system that fights them off before they get in. You are using a lot of zinc and vitamin C and other stuff. So people need to take zinc. The problem is when you get down to the cell level where that RNA virus gets in and is replicating, zinc is great, but it doesn't like to go in the cell. So this idea of an ionophore like chloroquine, hydroxychloroquine, those are drugs that were made for malaria and other problems like that. And like you said, they're now used for autoimmunity. They're wonderful. And it turns out that they help this entry into the cell of zinc. And later, if we want to, I can talk about drug, because hydroxychloroquine or chloroquine, its cousin, come from a tree bark called cinchona bark. So they're cinchona alkaloids, and the quinine is their parent. And then quinidine is actually a heart medication that's sort of the left-hand version of this. And then chloroquine, hydroxychloroquine were mostly used in malaria and other stuff, not autoimmunity. So yeah, that drug family helps the zinc in. Upside, it does that. Downside is on its own, it can have some cardiac side effects. With some of its drug combos, if you're in China, they're using antiviral drugs with it. They have to monitor people's hearts really closely. It works good, but they have to monitor. The azithromycin combo, which is actually based on a really tiny group of patients, by the way. And then there's, I think, a hospital in New York did a bigger group, but still not, you know, not thousands of people. Hydroxychloroquine is doing this thing of forcing zinc in the cell, which blocks viral replication. Azithromycin, the reason that they believe it has synergy with that is not so much that it's magic with zinc or anything, but azithromycin knocks down many of the other infections that would accelerate COVID's illness. So they think it might have been sort of like a happy accident that the two mechanisms were working together. Unlike like the antiviral drugs that go, you know, with hydroxychloroquine. So yeah, and what I've been telling people on these podcasts and the other interviews is, if you're gonna do chloroquine, hydroxychloroquine, quinine, any of the cinchona alkaloids, a doctor needs to prescribe it, number one, and it needs to be monitored. Okay, that's just this. No room to manipulate there, and it will work. But there's a couple of things in nature that have also been shown in studies to do the same thing. One, I mentioned my allergies earlier. So quercetin, a bioflavonoid, think about like the rind of most fruits and stuff. It's got lots of bioflavonoids. Quercetin is one of these things that will help zinc into cells, so that would be good. EGCG, which is the kind of the hyper focus part of green tea. So EGCG is a part of green tea. That's also very helpful. And a little known trace mineral called molybdenum that we use for other stuff. Turns out that also helps zinc go into cells too. So quercetin doesn't have a ton of cardiac side effects. EGCG, if you take too much, you'll get a fast heart rate because it's green tea extract. So you'd have to be careful there. But usually in the doses that are normally used, it's fine. And molybdenum is a trace mineral that, you know, you would do short term. But that's the important thing for people to know. Like zinc floating around in your blood, very good for the first responders, but to get it in the cells, it needs a helper. So hydroxychloroquine and chloroquine. So in the Chinese expert panel from Shanghai, where they had done the most cases of COVID and they published everything really quickly, and it was a lot of doctors. This is like 50 to 100 doctors that signed off on this panel thing. And I went into their hospital system because that's the only place you could find it at the moment. It's written in Mandarin, and I got it machine AI translated. So it's a little funky, but it's usable in the English, which I read better than Mandarin. And they're talking about all these things they've tried in this area of, you know, zinc ionophores and stuff like that. And it's really working well. And they give dosing for chloroquine, hydroxychloroquine, and depending on what you have available. The problem is it's been like that drug is marginalized in North America because we don't treat a lot of malaria here. So it's used for, like you said, lupus and a couple other things. So it's made in tiny quantities. So if all of a sudden everyone wants to, unless someone's making a lot, there's a problem there, you know, as far as supply and demand. But they definitely, you know, they talk about that. The other interesting thing they talk about, which I think is, I always bring up on these things because except for Facebook posts, nobody else will bring this up. And that is in China, as you might imagine, they have something called traditional Chinese medicine, which is not just acupuncture. It's also a very elaborate version of herbal medicine and some other things. And in the expert consensus opinion, traditional Chinese medicine, because that's available there, they emphasize that to keep you out of the hospital, but also to recover after your disease, which is huge. And it is a lot like what you and I do with personalized medicine, where it's based on you as a person, and then you bring the medicine into it as you as a person. It's not you get these five things no matter what your problem is, right? And I think that that's very important because what you can, if you read between the lines or sometimes in the lines from the Chinese doctors, they're saying, you know, their goal became, we don't need more people in the hospital. We need to prevent people from coming in. What will do that? There were two things they identified. Chinese medicine, which is just constitutional medicine, which your naturopath can do or any TCM provider, whatever, and oral vitamin C. Like those are the two things that they said, just do this, you'll probably stay out of the hospital. Or if you don't die in the hospital when you get out, those are the two things that'll help you recover the most. So I think that the whole zinc ionophore thing in the West, especially, we are enamored with single drugs doing a single thing. Chloroquine family, hydroxychloroquine probably does multiple things, probably will be helpful, but it's like not the, it is part of an answer to a problem, but it has to be monitored so heavy. I think I would be more preventive. And I mean, I take quercetin myself. There are very little downside unless you take too much and you have some loose bowels or something like that. But, you know, the natural things I think are worth doing just on the preventive side.
Yeah, thanks so much for saying that. needs to be monitored by a physician. I mean, I've spoken to, I think, at least three compounding pharmacies last month. It's April now, so that was March 2020 for the listeners' reference. And all of them said, we have a small supply. And most of them, you know, two out of three were not advertising. So they were just saying, yeah, we have it, but your patient has to be very sick. You know, they have to need it. You know, they have to be high risk, maybe not very sick, but they have to be high risk. So I know that a lot of people listen to podcasts and they think, okay, well, I can, you know, DIY or biohack my health. You can't biohack a pandemic.
Right. Right.
You know, with that said, you know, still take your vitamins if you're already taking them, but this is not the time to try to put this thing together on your own, especially if someone has pre-existing conditions, which might be another question for you to answer before we get into some other things like the elderberry, whole elderberry debate, is what are we seeing are the most high-risk pre-existing condition, health conditions that people have that are either ending up in the hospital or be dying from COVID-19?
Yeah. So I think pre-existing conditions are sort of a two-edged sword. So one is when I talk to people, they'll say, well, all right, I have that problem, whatever the pre-existing problem is. So now am I just screwed or what, you know, what, like, cause if I get COVID tomorrow, I'm not going to reverse this problem I've had my whole life. So I think you need to look at it kind of from a, take a step back point of view. 40%+ of North Americans have something in the spectrum of type 2 diabetes and are moderately to greatly overweight. Those are two of the biggest things. And it's not because of diabetes or obesity. It's because they're associated with what else? Cancer. They make your inflammatory chemistry just really like have a hair trigger. So if you have a hair trigger on inflammation and then you get an inflammatory viral process, it's like gas and fire going together. So you want to work on your underlying stuff, but like in the next couple of months where we're dealing with a pandemic or however many months, depending on who you listen to, what else can you do? Well, one of the things that's really important is these water-soluble nutrients that modulate your immune function are critical that they keep going in you. And if you already have, you're a smoker, or you have obesity or diabetes, or, you know, there's other things too. You got to support your body. So it's like inflammation is good. It triggers our immune system, but then it has to calm down. If you are, you know, let's say you take the trifecta of a smoker who's overweight and diabetic, you know, and this is not a judgment, people are who they are, but like if a virus like COVID-19 gets into that person, the inflammation that the virus causes in the immune fight kind of can trail on without modulation. And so stuff like vitamin C and glutathione support and zinc and all that helps to modulate all that. So the underlying conditions tend to be things that would trigger really an unrestricted inflammatory response. So the good inflammatory response goes bad because it goes too far. The other thing that happens is people that have maybe some latent respiratory virus or bacteria or whatever, that they don't, you can have those without symptoms. But if they're hanging out and COVID-19 comes in, sets up shop, they can wake up, and then you're dealing with two, three things to fight at the same time, and you get over inflamed. And that gets back to our discussion of the or the lung side of the problem. That's where that trouble comes from.
Excellent. Overview of the chronic disease conditions. Hopefully that's helpful. I think that's helpful for the listeners to get an idea of chronic inflammation being the underlying pathophysiology there. The big thing, I mean, it's kind of come and gone, but I'm still hearing about it as a whisper out there in the kind of ethers of social media, with people being overly concerned about elderberry, and it even came to the point where I think Gaia Herbs was defending elderberry in all of its glory. And just for the listeners, there has been elderberry syrup has been used successfully with some research for H1N1, the swine flu from 2009, as well as influenza A, which is the influenza from the Spanish flu. With that said, I mean, typically as practitioners, we don't just give somebody one herb and say, good luck, you know, have at it.
Right.
Look with this horrible virus that can mutate. But the question I have for you is maybe where does this whole thing come from, where people think the cytokine, the chemical messenger, interleukin-6, is increased so much by elderberry syrup that it's going to cause this cytokine from storm and kill somebody with coronavirus that in early stages? I mean, I haven't heard of any hospital personnel, nurses or doctors giving anybody elderberry syrup who's about to go on a ventilator. So I think that's out of the question. But in early cases, where did this come from? Where did this debate even arise from?
I think that's like one of the million-dollar questions. And it's I refer to pandemic time. It's sort of like 3 weeks seems like 3 years at this point, with just because the news, the data cycle, the what we know, what we don't know changes drastically over time. But in that timeline of being on, you know, not just doing interviews, but meeting with, you know, experts on Zoom calls about all this business and talking to people who are really well informed, you know, immunologists and people who know stuff more than I know. That's been one of the things, like from the very beginning, the elderberry, I'll call it the elderberry question or whatever. So here's the thing. Number one, so swine flu, H1N1, I had that in the 70s, and I had it in 2009 or whatever it came through last time. And it turned out that those of us who had it in the 70s were more susceptible than the rest of the people, which we all laughingly thought we were not, and that turned out very badly. So I've had it both times. The second time, I literally, like, you don't, like, that is a bad version of the flu. You don't feel like living, let alone taking herbs or whatever. So I had a giant bottle of elder extract next to my bed. I mean, a big one. And I would wake up, I'd drink water, and I would just hit on this bottle of elder extract, drinking as much as I could tolerate, and then I would fall back asleep. And I did that constantly through the first, you know, 4 or 5 days or whatever. I felt pretty horrible, and there was two waves of this. The 2009 version was way worse than the 1970s version, by the way. And I had some cytokine problems during that, but when I was taking the elder stuff, I did not die, A, as you can see, and B, it didn't make anything worse. And I think that's huge. So then when this whole thing came around with this particular COVID-19, and I saw somebody post something about, you know, Sambucus elder and astragalus, and there's a few other herbs that are kind of popular for immune and flu and stuff like that. And they're like, oh, it raises IL-6. IL-6 is what raises in a cytokine storm, ergo you will die if you take these things. And I thought, well, number one, that doesn't match my experience. I've never seen that with any respiratory-based cytokine, you know, driven bug. And so I thought, well, no, I'm just going to check myself. I'm going to fact check myself before I say what I normally do, which is that stupid. And so I start to read some data from Immunology Worlds and where they actually test cytokine activity. So while it's true, astragalus and sambucus and echinacea and stuff raise, and IL-6 is one of, like, let's say we know 150 in their family. There's probably 2,000 of these chemicals that help our immune system. So we pick on the one we know the most, IL-6. Yes, it goes up in a cytokine storm that kills you. Elder, astragalus, echinacea can raise it. The difference is if you look at actual research where they do the same units of IL, so IL-6 is measurable as any other lab test, right? So there's certain units that measure it. If you look at, okay, I give you elder, or I give you echinacea, or I give you astragalus or whatever, and how much does IL-6 go up? And then you look at SARS, H5N1, how much did IL-6 go up? It's the difference between a brand newborn baby-sized IL-6 version and a giant adult-sized IL-6 version. Which one are you more afraid of physically? Not the newborn baby. You're afraid of a giant human. Like, if something's going to attack you. Now, a newborn baby can make you not sleep and other unpleasant things maybe, but that's not, the baby's not going to jump up and kill you, right? So most herbal things or mushrooms, et cetera, that raise IL-6, two things. If you look at actual data, not just IL-6 as a term, which is cool, but you have to quantify it. If you look at actual data that says it goes up this much, it's somewhere between 0.1% and 10% of what the virus can do. But here's the other part. It is pulsatile, because you're not going to do intravenous, you know, sambucus or intravenous, you know, astragalus 24/7, whereas the virus is working 24/7. So if it, like it, when I had, H1N1, and I would wake up and literally drink. No one else was getting this bottle of herbs, by the way. Don't do this at home, but this is what I had going for me. I would unscrew the cork and drink out of the bottle. And that was my dosing strategy, because that's all I could pull together. I was really sick. The swine flu was there 24/7, creating its problem. Me taking it was at most every 3 or 4 hours. And not only did I not die, but it probably helped me with other problems. So herbal things, now there's another side of this, which is why you want to work with a clinician who knows botanical herbal medicine. But there are people who don't do well with echinacea or sambucus or astragalus or whatever else. You shouldn't take it. But it's not because it's going to kill you. It's because your body has other reasons it doesn't use that herb well. But so that's the basis of the problem. And I actually got in I will not say the nature of the expert panel, but because I've been on a few, but I actually got into a whole thing over this. And so there was a real live PhD immunologist who not only is an immunologist, but studies botanical medicine as an immunologist, which is a unique thing. And they know way more than I do. And they were of the same opinion as I. And it's not that I was trying to pick people, you know, who were the same opinion, but this person is super informed. And then I went and I looked at this, you know, oh, it's a baby version versus a giant version, cytokine storm. And it's like you could never, unless you pumped it in their veins, which would kill them from an allergy before it killed them from cytokine storm. You could never give enough sambucus or astragalus or whatever to kill someone with a cytokine storm. There were people on the other side who, this is my personal opinion. This is not, my opinion is never the ultimate truth. Unfortunately, it came from a very well-known and respected university that does a lot of integrative medicine. And their position was, and I'm just self-editing here. So their position, I'm just going to say their position literally when they came back, because I wrote in defense of what the immunologist was saying, and I said, look, clinically, this makes no sense because of all this stuff we just talked about. And they came back and they said, well, it does raise IL-6. IL-6 is involved in the cytokine storm that kills. So while we believe it is a conservative recommendation, we stand by our recommendation not to use any of these herbs. And I thought, well, okay. I mean, you can never out argue a conservative recommendation. Basically, that's the bottom line. So yeah, you know, I wouldn't freestyle. I wouldn't go out and, you know, drink gallons of elder or whatever. But on the order of actual science and actually what works clinically and all that, like whether it's astragalus or whether it's Sambucus or even echinacea or whatever, if you didn't have a problem with it before COVID, you're not going to have a problem with it with COVID. And that's the bottom line. If you're dying in the hospital, is Sambuca A, are you going to be in a hospital where they give you Sambucus? No, you're nowhere in the universe is that going to happen. But, you know, yeah, so there's timing to everything. But for prevention, kind of like the Chinese experts said, herbal medicine, which when you're talking about traditional Chinese medicine, that's a large part of it, herbal medicine and vitamin C are what we want you to stay out of the hospital with. Makes sense. When you're done in the hospital and you're trying to recover, we'd like you to do herbal medicine, TCM, and vitamin C. Great. Let's do that. If you're in the hospital, you be in the hospital. Do your thing.
Yeah, I like that approach. It would be nice if, you know, in an alternate universe, if the U.S. could get a little bit more integrated in on that global recommendations. But like you said, the conservative people have their conservative influencers, and their conservative influencers usually are holding big bags of money. So, you know, there's always that. So,
money talks.
Yeah. It's like our conservative scientific estimate, meanwhile, they're, you know, hiding a big paycheck. By you know who. So yeah, it's, you know, anything you hear on a podcast, you should go and talk to your naturopathic doctor about, like you said. And the ideal is that you have somebody that you've already been talking to for months or years, so they already know you,
right?
And know the foods and the herbs and the medications that you have allergies or reactions to, so that when you do get sick and you can't get a test for COVID-19, or you have to wait a long time for a test, and now we're waiting for the antibody test, and basically they can work with you to create a unique individualized plan for you that fits you and your needs, which is not what any public health government organization is going to say, because from a public health point of view, they can't, you know, there's not an affordability in saying, you know, everybody go find these practitioners, and, you know, it doesn't fit their paradigm either. So it's a different, there's two different worlds colliding in that, in that whole recommendation world. So basically, the whole elderberry thing was really kind of mind-boggling to me, because elderberry is pretty much generally recognized as safe. Unless you have too much of it, then you can get diarrhea, or if it's not cooked down enough or extracted right, then you can get sick, maybe vomit, but it's not like a lot of other herbs out there. And there are so many other herbs that, you know, you mentioned some alkaloid as a constituent, and there's a lot of herbs that have alkaloids that are very toxic, and low dose toxic herbs that could be far worse. So it was kind of funny to me, because I, you know, kids take elderberry and it tastes good, so they like it. So I was kind of like, wow, really? You guys are focusing on elderberry? Should we also look at baby food next?
Yeah.
Just didn't really make any sense logically to me. I mean, echinacea would make more sense to me. Be careful with echinacea or something if you have, you know, a lot of stuff going on with your health and then you get COVID-19. Well, moving right along, IV nutrients are really great for viral infections, amongst a lot of other things like chronic illnesses, cancer, adjunctive therapies for chronic illnesses. But specifically, what I wanted to highlight for our listeners are things that are relatively common for people that are probably already undergoing treatment with a naturopathic doctor or functional medicine practitioner for things like chronic reactivating mononucleosis, Epstein-Barr virus, CMV, HHV6, and these being some of the chronic infections that cause fatigue. And, you know, if you go and Google something like HHV6, basically they say, well, we have no conventional treatment for this chronic infection. Good luck is basically what I've found.
Yes.
That's not really what anybody wants to hear, especially with the symptoms of which that particular virus and things like reactivated mono, the combination feels like walking through a room full of molasses every day with the heavy body and brain fatigue and things like that. Mm-hmm. I'm speaking from experience, which is always fun, as you know. To learn about these infections from firsthand experience. So, you know, there's probably a lot of people listening to this. If you don't have reactivated mononucleosis, over 90% of adults have been infected with mono, and you can have a reactivation. You know, a good way to get a reactivation is, you know, like remodeling your house and starting a business at the same time, or any stressful event, like watching too much news before going to bed during a pandemic. So that could be a way to get a reactivation, amongst many others, like going to medical school. So my question is for you, now that we've kind of set the stage for the listeners, is that what are, besides, you know, someone going to like an IV nutrient clinic and just saying, well, I want to boost optimize my immune system, what are some of the key IV nutrients that you look at for viral infections?
Yeah, I think, you know, if, and this is one of those things where it's, you know, what you have access to and the expertise of the people. And just, I think to keep in mind that there's a lot of parts of, you know, places where people are listening to us where they might not have access to intravenous nutrient therapy or very much of it. But there, I think there's two things I'd like to leave in people's minds. One is, because it's made the news and social media a lot, in China and in other parts of the world, in the hospital setting, they use vitamin C with people. And here's, to shorten the story up, I told you about the expert panel. One of the experts was already researching IV vitamin C for other problems in the hospital, was using it, knew it was safe, the whole deal. And so they said, well, while we're at it and we have these people in the ICU, let's give them IV vitamin C because it's helping with these other problems. I think it will help with this. It was like, I mean, they were, you know, any good idea that somebody could back up, they were doing. And of a group of 350 people in ICU, and I don't know how they pick them or whatever, they pick 50, and they gave them IV vitamin C continuously, so every day. And they saw a couple things that were remarkable in the hospital. One was there were no side effects. And that's even, consider, these are in ICU patients. They're getting a lot of other drugs. No side effects from the vitamin C. The next thing was none of the 50 died. They all discharged from the hospital. That's pretty huge with COVID-19. And the other was that the cost was negligible compared to all this stuff. And the final that probably made the cost benefit analysis huge is they were in the hospital 3 to 5 days less than people who didn't get IV vitamin C. 3 to 5 days in ICU in North America can be $500,000. I mean, it is expensive to be in ICU. And I didn't know that. And I was talking to a government official that's trying to get this to the different health departments and stuff. And they said that their partner was in ICU for a day and it was $100,000, you know? So, I mean, ICU is not a cheap thing in North America. And even if it was, you know, $100, it's a hospital bed for 3 to 5 days. So those things got my attention, got everyone else's attention. So here's the thing people need to know. If you're not in China, you getting vitamin C in the hospital, you can't request, I mean, you request it, but if they give it to you or not is up to the hospital. Vitamin C in hospitals has been used in some cases in North America for sepsis, et cetera, but it's not a thing here, right? So you can beg for it all you want. You're not going to get it. 4 hospitals or more in New York just on their own started doing this. Other pockets around the country are doing it, but it's not every hospital. So just know that going in. But here's the thing. You're in a hospital with COVID-19 and you're in ICU. You are not going anywhere. So you're on an IV continuously. And what they found in the hospital is that they give the vitamin C metered out throughout the 24 hours. It's in the background. It's going in and replacing the stuff you're burning up with this big inflammatory thing in your lungs and your hemoglobin and all that. And so it's sort of like in the background being your metabolic guardian angel the whole time you're there. Reduces your stay, you know, all that business. Outside of the hospital, what we normally do are shorter infusions of vitamin C and some minerals. Zinc is sometimes given there too. And what I have seen personally in the last couple of months, where some people we might know tested positive, some people had the right symptoms and didn't test, or, you know, there's not a lot of testing available, at least in this time period. If we could give people a higher dose of vitamin C in the first day that they had their fever, their disease seemed to last a shorter amount of time. Now, this is anecdotal, and it's from a small group of people, but makes sense. So outpatient, if you see someone that does IVs and you're feeling like you've been exposed a lot, but maybe you're feeling okay, a higher dose of vitamin C with some minerals would be a great idea. In the hospital where you're real fragile and you're going to be there anyway, so you don't need big anything, a continuous dose appeared to work really well. And I summarized this for the International Society of Orthomolecular Medicine, we call it the Chinese protocols. I've summarized it and given it and the Chinese expert data to, you know, entire states and hospitals and other things. The problem is the system moves so slow, we might be out of crisis before they decide to use it. But it's very useful. It probably costs, raw costs, you're probably looking at under $30 a day, you know, when you consider one drug that they're giving in ICU, you know, that it's not even a thing. But in the hospital, if you could get that, that'd be wonderful. But preventing you going to the hospital, my experience and the experience of some of the Chinese experts actually is, in addition to basic stuff like lifestyle and individualized herbal and other medicine stuff, you know, boluses of vitamin C or oral vitamin C just taken every day seems to help you stay out of the hospital. So when you go for IV nutrients, there's kind of two directions. Big vitamin C doses kind of go on their own with a few minerals and stuff. And they've been actually shown in some studies to be good with other viruses, Epstein-Barr and the family HHV6 comes from, et cetera. And we do that a lot with those, or maybe someone's getting fever the first 24 hours of a flu or something. Really helps, it shortens their disease period. The other, though, are lower doses of vitamin C with other nutrients that would back up glutathione function, help vitamin C stay in your system, would back up these other kind of, let's keep you in a modulated inflammatory cycle, not a pro-inflammatory cycle. So those are the most common things people do in IV nutrient therapy in offices that do it. And thankfully, those are the two things you usually need if you do. Hospital-wise, if you're in China, you're probably more in luck. Other countries in North America, it's up to the individual hospital to decide we want to do this because it wasn't something they were doing before.
And how long has China been using IV vitamin C in their hospitals for? Have they been using it before the COVID-19 pandemic?
Well, yeah, they, like us, were using it before COVID for sepsis, but also in China, based on the interview with the one. So the expert panel is a bunch of like 50 plus experts. One expert was researching vitamin C IV for critical care patients, and it was, you know, sepsis and a bunch of other nasty things that kill people. And they basically said, look, we don't know how this virus is going to play out. We got to get people out of the hospital as fast as we can. This is safe. It's cheap. Let's add this to the mix. So it's not like they only did IV vitamin C. But the cool thing also, which is a big hill I have to get over with hospitals in North America when I talk to them, is, well, we're giving all these other drugs in the ICU, will the vitamin C interrupt? And they just do it right along with everything else, and it's not been a problem at all. So that's kind of nice that they did that. Yeah.
Yeah.
And they did it, you know, they were doing it before, but they really ramped it up when they started to deal with COVID because they ran out of hospital space.
Yeah, that makes sense. And then for the more chronic cases, so if somebody already has some chronic viral stuff causing chronic fatigue or, you know, keeping them from working full time pre-COVID-19,
right,
would they be more at high risk for getting COVID-19 than somebody who doesn't have, you know, like CMV and EPV?
Yeah. It's a high probability. So you can't say that everybody with chronic infections is more likely, because some people are doing really well and their immune system is really good and all that. But one thing about, especially viruses, but some of the sneakier bacteria, like, you know, the mycoplasma family and stuff, they don't go away. So like, you know, you get strep throat or something, and if it's effectively treated, it may go away. If you have a virus, you minimize the virus, your immune system keeps track of it, but it could always be there in a small amount. People with a lot of chronic infections, you can get them beat down to the point where they're almost non-existent. They're not a problem for you. If you get a really bad infection, like a COVID type infection, and they all wake up at the same time, you're more likely to need more support, more respiratory support, et cetera. So if you're a patient that would be, say, a classic quote unquote Lyme patient where they've got lots of infections, or you've had, you know, five bouts of recurrent Epstein-Barr or any other thing, you need to be a little more vigilant. I think more like if you don't have COVID, more prevention for those folks is warranted. Because the last thing you want is five things to wake up instead of one, you know, and that's a problem. It's on the level of the others, you know, diabetes and other lung disease and smokers and, you know, all that stuff. The more infections you have effectively dealt with, but that aren't totally gone from your body, the more trouble you can get into. Yeah.
That makes sense to me. And then how much does the rest of our lifestyle play into this? You know, if somebody is at home and they don't have any supplements because they don't have a naturopathic doctor and they're listening to this and they can still buy their groceries at the store, how important is it that they don't eat, you know, popcorn for dinner and drink six pack of beer or soda and sleep 5 hours a night or something like that?
Yeah, I because I've done so many interviews, it's like this is a recurrent question. It kind of human nature. Now there are people who are perfect, and I'm not talking to perfect people, but human nature for the rest of us in the world, when we're like cooped up at home, and we may or may not be getting the death illness and all this stuff, like your mind goes to places that your desire to eat as a human in modern times has nothing to do with your nutrition. It has everything to do with every other brain and mental, emotional problem you have. And so normally people are drawn to the wrong kind of non-immune supportive food or drink when there's stress. So, you know, people get under stress. Really, really perfect folk will have a salad. Everybody else is going to have donuts or popcorn or beer or whatever. So what you have to do is step back and say, I buy my feelings. I understand this sucks for everybody. I don't want to get this. Or if you do have it, I don't want it to stay. I don't want to die from it. All this legit, right? You have to then kind of step back and say, okay, my desire is to eat donuts, or my desire is to eat, you know, whatever that's not good for you. You could go in a million directions. My desire is to have too much of a substance or whatever it is. You got to step back and say, is that good for the body I live in that's going to keep me alive through this? Like, do everything you can. If imagine if your grandma was there with you. So a lot of people still have grandmother. Mine's been gone for a long time. But like, imagine if grandma was with you and giving you the best grandma dietary advice. Would she really go for the all beer and donuts diet, or, you know, or whatever it is? It's where we seek comfort when we're not feeling well is generally, it's just this paradox us humans have. We don't do the most healthy things. This is not the time to push that into the ticket, because you, like I was saying, you're fighting stuff you don't even know that's coming around. You know, every virus and bacteria, there's stuff all over. Your immune system does a great job. Don't undercut it, you know, with that. So getting enough sleep, moving your body around, even if you're housebound, walk around more, get your big muscles moving. That moves your blood. It gets it through the liver. It gets your immune system activated. Stay hydrated, because that has a lot to do with your respiratory direct immunity and other good things, of course. All of the color in nature is there for many reasons. One of them is good stuff to eat tends to have a lot of color. So colorful vegetables, some of the fruits, they have a lot of these natural compounds we're talking about. You know, eating a balance to whatever way you do it of your proteins and fats and stuff. Not a lot of junk sugars, not a lot of junk calories. Definitely you don't at this point need not only sugar, but like a lot of additives. Additives are more junk for your immune system to deal with. So just clean, easy, straightforward. And, you know, think of what your grandma would tell you, and it probably was right. You know, not so much packaged stuff. And you can have little, you know, like let's say you're sheltering in place or whatever they call it in your town. You're not leaving your house. You know, you can build in little indulgences, and that's fine. But I have literally seen people where they're like, well, if I'm going to die, you know, it's like, this is great thinking. Well, if I'm going to die, well, not everyone's dying, number one, but okay, you go there. I'm going to go out eating Krispy Kreme donuts and whatever. And, you know, like, okay, so you're going to survive a pandemic and have diabetes on the other side, or what? Don't do that to yourself. Super important. Yeah.
Yeah. I've been thinking about that. You know, how many people are going to have diabetes on the other side of this who already have it. And I was going past the McDonald's in the town I'm at here in Montana, and a lot of people were, the McDonald's is open. All the other restaurants are closed, and maybe that's why more people are at McDonald's. And I recognize, you know, people maybe get sick of what is being cooked at home, or they don't know how to cook. So, you know, maybe buy a crock pot, figure it out.
You know, I've definitely seen that in my town. And I was talking to a doctor in Alaska, and we were talking about a patient that we shared, but it was like, I said, now is everything closed up there? How's it going? And he says, well, what I'm telling everyone is, if you're out of work, I know that Taco Time will be hiring, because there is a never ending line at the drive through to Taco Time in it's Alaska. So there's not that many fast food outlets, but it's like, yeah, you know, I think due to boredom, but also like in the modern society, a lot of people don't cook, you know, and you're not that used to making food. The same thing that will drive you crazy being the internet and the availability of stuff, like there are endless YouTube videos on, I have no idea how to cook. How do I make something in 15 minutes that I can eat? You trust me, you can find a way to make food. And probably it's parts of the grocery store that are not oversold too. Like the fresh produce area, there's generally stuff there, you know, things like that. And like you said, you know, crockpot, there's like 100 crockpot people on YouTube that will teach you how to make the most amazing food in a crockpot. And you can diminish that because, I mean, talk about like, you know, not just maybe too much sugar or whatever, but the amount of processed stuff you have to do to make fast food. It's not the greatest gambit for your main diet. Like, you know, yeah, occasionally whatever, but that is not the key to health. I mean, there's a reason when they did, you know, Morgan Spurlock did Supersize Me that his liver enzymes went up and all. It's like, when I saw his labs after what 30 or 40 days, I didn't believe it would be that bad, but it was that bad. It's because you're just eating, you know, mostly not food that you're dealing with. So, you know, buy into your, you know, whatever you're thinking that makes you want to eat or drink the wrong thing. Acknowledge it. If you need an indulgent, pick one that's, you know, not too damaging and, you know, makes you feel like you had fun and then move on, you know, because, and we all see it and it's, you know, I mean, it's made to be funny and all that. And it is on, you know, on social media, things can be either funnier and raging, but like people are home and it's like, how many people are like day drinking all day long, you know, and, or whatever, you know, just cause like I'm home, I'm out of work, I'm whatever, I'm just going to deal with it this way. Well, probably as many or more people are doing it just by eating really in a non-immune friendly way as well. So yeah, just, you know, just back up, do what you need to do to feel like you had a win. And then remember, you got to feed your body. It's the only thing to fight off what's kind of, you know, what's around you.
Yeah, that's so true. It is wrestling with our, you know, we're stuck inside with our inner demons. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's like, oh, you know.
Yeah, I mean, if you're not going to work and diverting yourself from your inner demons or, you know, you're this, or you're working from home, you realize how much other time you spend at work that maybe you're diverting from your, you know, it's like pretty soon you're just there with you. And
yeah.
And maybe a bunch of other people you live with, but still it's like, you know, what'd be great, like a really big sugar hit right now or.
Yep.
And it, you know, it's great for a very short time, but it's not great for your immune system.
Yeah. I think of like the Homer Simpson moments, you know, all donuts and pizza. And yeah,
like a dinner of pizza, donuts and Duff beer or whatever it is.
Yeah.
That Homer has. Yeah.
Yeah, I like that you mentioned day drinking because, you know, doing intermittent fasting or fasting and drinking beer is not fasting. So hopefully people have
figured out. Yeah, yeah, that's, we could probably do a whole show on that. But yeah,
yeah.
You can't fast while consuming calories. And in addition to alcohol, day drinking gives you a lot of calories. So.
Yeah.
It's not a fasting strategy is all I'm saying.
Yeah, that's a whole other metabolic end of the spectrum. Well, I think we've answered most of the main questions that I've seen out there that everybody has on this whole pandemic. And, you know, I think one of the other big questions a lot of people have is, you know, that nobody knows is, will this go away? You know, it's April now in the summer, like influenza does, and then will it come back in the fall or will it just stay all through the summer? And that's been a debate I've seen amongst the immunologists and public health experts. As far as any other closing remarks around the coronavirus pandemic or anything else that we haven't touched on that you'd like to share with the audience?
You know, I think always take a step back. I think inferring too much from today's latest, you know, data that comes out or today's latest whatever is kind of dangerous because tomorrow's might be totally different. You know, right now they're saying, you know, this doesn't appear to be seasonally affected like influenza, you know, A or B might be. We don't know that, but also it's pandemic and that there's a lot of different dynamics with pandemics because they move around the globe. And so it might not be seasonal, but it may come back to your area. So I think for the moment, you know, being on the cautious side, being on the preventive side, like we talked about, and, you know, honestly speaking, based on every other country where, and I do know people in other countries, so I'm not making this up, but like whether it's South Korea or China or Australia or South Africa or Europe, where I've talked to people, one of the unique things, and it underscores what we talked about a lot that I just want to leave people with, is whatever the you could say native or indigenous sort of medicine that grew up in that region is, if people avail themselves of it and basic nutrition and other stuff, they do better. They appear to be less likely to go to the hospital, or they recover better if they do have to go. And it doesn't matter, like whether it's Ayurvedic practitioners I've talked to, or in China with TCM, or in Korea with, they have a Korean medicine that's a version of that, or, you know, North American botanical traditions or whatever, or naturopathy, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, all around the world. And what's cool about that to me is it's not a formulaic thing. It's about whoever you work with, who deals with you as an individual, whatever they do, it's agnostic to the kind of treatment they do almost. It will help you because they're working with you. They're working with you as a human. And whether it's, you know, most of those have botanicals in common, you know, herbs and things, but they all have a lot of different stuff in common. And they're all different botanicals. They're all different, whatever, but they all seem to work wherever you are. So I think, you know, yes, the nutrition stuff, general health things, they don't go away during a pandemic. Vitamin C's and N-acetylcysteine, probably the two cheapest and most helpful things you can get, hopefully. And then, you know, if you're really concerned and you're working with somebody who's a practitioner in these areas, just get with them. If you don't know people, then look for people who are trained in, you know, in person to person, you know, interpersonal medicine. And that seems to be one of the biggest predictors of either prevention of needing the hospital or recovery after, because you can't control your hospital experience. You can hope it's a enlightened hospital or whatever, but like you can't control that part. Stay out of the hospital is your first four priorities. And if you get out of the hospital, don't go back, you know. You know, indigenous medicine, wherever you're from, is really showing up to be probably a big part of the answer there. And it's just a medicine you and I do. It's just, you know, it's maybe the same tools, but you need something different than your neighbor needs. And that's the most important thing, I think.
Excellent. Thanks so much, Dr. Paul Anderson. And everybody stay safe out there and take care of yourselves and your community. Until next time, thanks so much and share the show with everybody you know. We'll be back with another show soon. Now here's for my mandatory disclaimer. This is a medical information podcast and is only for general information purposes. It does not substitute or constitute the practice of medicine or any medical practices, including the giving of medical advice to any individual. And please observe that no doctor-patient relationship has been formed here. This medical podcast offers health, hormone, fitness, and nutrition information and is designed for educational purposes only. You should not rely on this information as a substitution for, nor does it replace professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. If you have any concerns or questions about your health, you should always consult with a physician or other healthcare professional. Do not disregard, avoid, or delay obtaining medical or health-related advice and appropriate treatment from your healthcare professional. Users should seek the care of their physician or healthcare professional for any such conditions. The use of any information provided on this podcast is solely at your own risk. The contents and topics of this podcast have not been evaluated by the FDA nor approved by any other government or official body. The topics and content covered is not intended to diagnose, cure, or prevent any disease or disorder of any kind. Developments in medical research may impact the health, fitness, and nutritional advice that appears here on the podcast in the future episodes. No assurance can be given that the advice contained in this podcast will always include the most recent findings or developments in medicine with respect to the particular material covered. If you are in the United States and think you are having a medical or health emergency, call your healthcare professional or 911 immediately. Thank you for listening, and we look forward to hearing your feedback and looking forward to have you on future podcasts. Thank you.